Our subject tonight is the Reformation in England and Scotland. And to understand the Reformation in England and Scotland, and I think it is important for us to understand this because most of us would probably trace our ancestry back specifically to these particular church traditions. Somebody has said that one out of every five Americans at the time of the Reformation was a Scotch-Irish Presbyterian, and that the revolution that took place in America was really a Presbyterian revolution. So in order to understand even or to evaluate that statement, you need to know something about what has happened. Now, I have a couple of overheads that are on their way. My wife is bringing them. I left them at home. But let's begin with Henry VIII. When we look over what is happening at the same time as Martin Luther across the island to England, Henry VIII is king. He began to reign in the year 1509, and he was at that time 18 years old. He ruled to the year 1547. So he is in a very strategic point here. The Reformation is in full bloom in that period of time. As you remember, Luther begins his movement in 1517. So it's the year 1509 when Henry VIII begins to reign. He was quite an outstanding person just from looking at the person. He had a golden beard. He was a very accomplished tennis player. He was the best in the nation in both archery and wrestling. He was a very good hunter. He was good at jousting. And he was a very accomplished musician. He also wrote masses, and as you know, he was within the strain at this time of pure Catholicism. He was trained in his training. When a person wanted an education, his education was a religious education. And so he was trained to be an ecclesiastic. So he had a pretty good knowledge of theology. Just as today, when the king is or the queen is trained, they get a pretty good knowledge, well-rounded. They get a fine education. And so he was trained and considered himself a fairly good scholar. In fact, he aspired to scholarship. And so in his early reign, he had Cardinal Wolsey as his chancellor and who directed the religious affairs. And this man has been said to be a combination of Innocent III, Benjamin Disraeli, and Beau Brummel all in one, which is some combination. The people, though, as a general rule, hated the clergy. The clergy controlled a tremendous amount of land at this time. In fact, we're going to see in Scotland that the Catholic Church appeared to own, at the time of the Reformation, about half of the land of Scotland. And naturally, they would loan it out to the various peasants. The peasants would work the land, and they would receive the revenues. So the people hated clergy at this time because of the corruption and their power. There was a increase of heresy. People were beginning to have this spirit of inquiry that was arising at this period of time. And there were 342 trials in 15 years for heresy during this period of time. So you can see that the Reformation was something that didn't just drop out of nowhere, but there was a tremendous movement of change of thinking at this period we are looking at. Cambridge, in the years 1521 through 1525, had a lot of very interesting men. William Tyndale had been at Cambridge, Miles Coverdale, Hugh Latimore, Edward Fox, Nicholas Ridley, Thomas Cranmer. So there was a tremendous growth of intelligent scholarship that was centered at Cambridge at this period of time. Now, Henry VIII was a person who read what was going on, and he read Luther's treatises. Remember, we pointed out that Luther wrote a number of treatises at the time of the very beginning of the Reformation. And since Henry VIII considered himself a theologian, he began to interact with Luther's arguments. And so in the year 1521, now remember Luther, 1517, And then Luther wrote his address to the nobility and some of his early Reformation papers to the year 1521. And so that's just at the very beginning of the Reformation. But you can see Henry VIII is up on things, what's going on in Germany at this point. And he writes a letter, a treatise, in 1521, an assertion of the seven sacraments against Martin Luther. So you have a very interesting statement here. You have a king of England who is learned enough in theology to write against Luther. And he says a very interesting number of things in there. He says, quote, "What serpent is so venomous as he who calls the Pope's authority a tyranny?" So he didn't mince any words. He goes on to say, "What a great limb of the devil he is, endeavoring to tear the Christian members of Christ from their head." Now remember who says this, because he is going to say a number of other things that's going to change entirely. Because of his great defense of the Roman Catholic faith at that period of time, Leo X gives to Henry VIII the title Defender of the Faith. And this is my Defender of the Faith here. Thank you. He gives the title Defender of the Faith to Henry VIII. The thing that's interesting about this is that now, from now on, whenever you hear about the titles of the English kings, they will have this title, Defender of the Faith. And where they got that title was from the Pope at this period of time. So when Elizabeth is said to be the Defender of the Faith, that's a title that goes back to Leo X giving it to Henry VIII. However, we're going to see that the issues got a little complicated. Now, when Luther gets word of this treatise and he reads it, now, how do you think Luther, knowing from your study of church, how do you think Luther would respond to a king writing against him? Well, Luther responds in the year 1525 by saying, and I ask your indulgence for my language here, but I'm quoting Luther, quote, "That lubberly ass," close quote, "that from that frantic madman, that king of lies, by God's disgrace, king of England," and so on. So you can see Luther was quite a vociferous man when he wanted to get riled up over something. This is the main one we want to look at. We are looking at the rulers of England. When we look at the Reformation in England, the Reformation in England is tied to the rulers. The Reformation in Geneva, the Reformation in Germany was quite different. And one of the reasons why you can immediately think about it is because they did not have a strong centralized government. Germany was weak and divided into various electorates, and so you could sort of have your own thing going depending on which prince was in advance. Whereas in England, where you have a strong monarch, whatever way the monarch is going to go is going to greatly affect the church life. Now, Henry VIII married Catherine of Aragon. Some of you probably know this history fairly well. Let me see if I can get the exact chronology here. Henry VIII made, well, pardon me, let me go back. Henry VII made a contract for his son, Henry VIII, to marry when he was only 6 years old. Then when he married, he had five children by his first wife. But only one lived, and her name was Mary. And this Mary does not provide, of course, a male heir. And so Henry VIII decides to divorce his first wife. And in the year 1533, he takes up with Anne Boleyn, which is current knowledge from the various plays and stuff that have been going on. She is already 4 months pregnant when he marries her, so he has been having an affair with her. In September of the same year, Elizabeth is born, and he puts away his wife, and so the Pope takes the King of England and excommunicates him. And he tells the King of England that he is excommunicated because he has put away his wife, and he says the following. We decree that the sons of King Henry by said Anne, and the sons of all other aforementioned, born or to be born, the rest of their descendants to that degree to which the penalties of wrath extend, so on, go on and talk about putting a curse upon them. The interesting section is that the Pope says, all the subjects of the same King of England we do absolve and utterly release from their oath of fidelity, from their allegiance, and from all kind of subjection to the King and the other persons aforementioned, commanding them nevertheless on pain of excommunication that they utterly and entirely withdraw themselves from obedience to the said King Henry, his officials, judges, and magistrates, and do not regard them as superiors or obey their commands. So what, because of Henry divorcing his wife and taking up with Anne Boleyn, the Pope excommunicates Henry VIII, and furthermore tells all the people within the land that they no longer have to obey him as king. So the issue is, what is the king going to do? Well, the king declares himself head of the state, head of the church, and makes a break with the Roman Catholic Church, and he passes a statute of supremacy, that the king is sovereign over both church and state. So he begins to persecute two different groups. He persecutes the Protestant critics of his theology, and he persecutes the Catholic critics of his ecclesiastical supremacy. His main position is the king is supreme in all matters. So to him, religion is something that the king decides. He decides that he's going to confiscate a number of the monasteries, and so 578 monasteries are closed. The major reason for doing this is the king needed money. And so as he closes the monasteries, he sells the land and other spoils. He evidently realizes about $140 million as the result of doing all this, which greatly increases his coffers of his realm. And so he is able to control the realm in a pretty good way. He has the money, and he has absolute power. So what he does is he permits a Bible to be printed, the Coverdale Bible. And he is trying to make some mild changes. He has to sort of decide, what is my faith going to be? And so he decides that he is going to keep basically the Catholic tradition, but he's going to get rid of the Latin and use the English Bible. So he permits the English Bible to be permitted. He says that you not have any images, relics, or miracles, or any superstition. No pilgrimages. He does say that they should not have private reading of the Bible. He wants reading of the Bible in the churches in English, but he doesn't want private interpretation. So he has this Catholicism, and he's trying to moderate the Catholicism to make it work for his system. Now, when Henry VIII dies, and of course he is a strong ruler all of his days, the English church is not really reformed in any way, because he has kept a strong hand, as he dies, his son, Edward VI, comes to the throne. This is a son of Henry by Jane Seymour. He is a very weak young boy. He is educated, though, by Cranmer, and Cranmer is a strong Protestant. At this time, in England, many Protestants return to England. They have fled under Henry VIII, and a tremendous Protestant influx is coming into the land. And since the boy is underage, he basically is not running the country. The people who are running the country are a number of what we would call Calvinistic Anglicans at this point. The first Book of Common Prayer is written in the year 1548, and Cranmer is the one who writes the first Book of Common Prayer. He's a very gifted man. He will meet a very desperate end, but at this particular point, he is the ecclesiastical power in the land, and he is moving toward a moderate Calvinistic Anglicanism. Catholics in doctrine are persecuted during this period of time. So there isn't any religious freedom at this point. However, Edward the VI dies July 6th in 1553 at age 15. So that leaves the place in an uproar. The question is, who is to succeed? And so the person who is to succeed is Mary. She is also known affectionately as Bloody Mary, not because she really deserves that title. There wasn't really as much blood shed in her reign as you might think. She only reigns from 1553 to 1558, which is just 5 years. Remember, she is the daughter of Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon. She is 37 years old when she comes to the throne, and she comes at a very difficult time, because there has been now a number of years of Protestantism, and everybody suspects her as she comes that she will try to impose the Roman Catholic faith on the church. At first, she does things very carefully. She has Mass privately for herself. She doesn't reinstitute the Mass, but she starts having it done privately. Then she revokes Edward's Protestant laws that were really passed by the people that were around Edward. And then in the year 1554, she restores Mass and further declares that heresy trials are illegal. But there are attempts to overthrow her. And so because of the attempts to overthrow her, she institutes a purge, and some 300 people are killed. And this is where she is called Bloody Mary. A number of people are put to death during this time. She marries Philip, who is the son of Charles V of Spain. And this gets the whole country in an uproar because they feel that they will be incorporated into Spain. And, of course, Spain is a rigidly Catholic country, and the people do not want to have Catholicism as a whole imposed upon the land. And so she is in this position, and there is quite a reaction at this point, but she persecutes a little bit more. And at this particular time, there is the putting to death of Ridley and Latimer. Latimer says at this time, as he is at the stake, "Play the man. We shall this day light a candle by God's grace in England, as I trust shall never be put out." So there is people giving their faith for the truth of the Reformation as they see it at this particular point. The next fact that we should note is, let me cite one more thing about this persecution. Cranmer, as he is being put to death, Cranmer, he at first, under persecution, said, "I renounce and abhor and detest all manner of heresies and errors of Luther and Zwingli." And he professes belief in the seven sacraments, in transubstantiation, purgatory, in all other teachings of the Roman Church. But Mary refuses to accept that it's sincere and sends him to the stake. And as he is at the stake, he says, as he is on the at the place of the stake, he says, "And now I come to the great thing which so much troubleth my conscience more than anything that I ever did or said in my whole life. And that is the setting abroad of a writing contrary to the truth, which I here now renounce and refuse, as written for fear of death. And that is all such bills and papers which I have written or signed with my own hand since my degradation. And forasmuch as my hand offendeth writing contrary to my heart, my hand shall first be punished therefore, for it shall be first burned. And as for the Pope, I refuse him as Christ's enemy and Antichrist." And he sticks out his hand and lets his hand get burned first to a crisp as he dies in the flames. So Mary is at this time in high hand. She becomes pregnant again, but then she is stricken with a fever and dropsy, and then dies. And as she dies, Elizabeth comes to the throne. It is amazing that Elizabeth was allowed to live, but Mary let her live. And Elizabeth, you remember, is a daughter by Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn. And this is the famous Elizabeth, who has the glorious reign. She's a very intelligent person. She knew French, Italian, Latin, and Greek, and she knew Protestant theology. So she was a Protestant, but about two-thirds of the country was Catholic. And she was not a very devout Protestant. She knew Protestant theology, and so she decides she's going to try to follow a middle course. Mary tried to reinstitute Catholicism and did a fairly good job. Elizabeth decides that since she is more of a Protestant, and she realizes that if she tries to lean toward Catholicism, then really she is invalidated as a monarch, because she really does not have a claim to the throne if Catholicism is true, because she is really a bastard. She is an illegitimate child of Henry VIII, because the marriage of Anne Boleyn to Henry VIII would be an invalid marriage, because Catherine of Aragon would have been the only true wife of Henry VIII. And therefore, the line of succession would pass through the line of Catherine of Aragon, or to the French, I mean, to the Spanish line. So she can't become a Catholic. So she decides on a moderate Protestantism. She is the head of the church, and she declares an act of uniformity, that there is to be one faith for the realm. And in the year 1563 and 1566, eventually what is written are the 39 Articles of Religion, which are to be the doctrinal basis of the Anglican Church. Now, these 39 Articles are very important, because these are the same articles today that are the articles that the Episcopal Church holds to, the Anglican Church holds to, the Methodist Church holds to. The Methodist Church bases its stand, since they grow out of, they have a book of doctrine which is based upon the 39 Articles. Now, the 39 Articles do have a good deal of good theology in it. Predestination is taught in it. Justification by faith is taught in it. Spiritual presence in the Lord's Supper is taught in it. So the 39 Articles, at this particular point, do have a Calvinistic understanding and a base to it. There is, however, a compromise in the area of church polity and church government. The doctrine is Calvinistic, but the practice of the church is going to be a combination of many of the elements from Catholicism. Mass is abolished, but the person will still be called a priest, and he will still wear a white surplice. Catholics will be persecuted, but there will be no actual freedom of religion at this point. At this particular point, you get a growth of people in Elizabeth's reign who want to purify the church, and they want to make the church more biblical. And these become known as the Puritans. So the Puritans that we are going to see later on coming to America, they will have a history that begins in Elizabeth's reign, and they will continue through a long struggle in here until it gets so bad that many of them will migrate to America, because they do not see any future in England. They do not feel that the church can be purified. And so they will come to America and try to do something different. You get a group, for example, such as Thomas Cartwright, who is at Cambridge at this time. He had also been studying in Geneva. And when he goes to teach at Cambridge, he teaches that the Scripture teaches, without doubt, Presbyterianism as the form of government taught in the Bible. And so he wanted the Presbyterianism, no episcopal orders, no ritual, popular election of ministers. A Puritan said that the prayer book was culled and picked out of that popish dunghill. So they didn't want a mass book. They didn't want any kneeling after communion. No altar, just a table. No recited prayers, and no state control of the church. These were the items that the Puritans put their stress on. Elizabeth, however, is in control, and she remains in control. She has a long, long reign. And since she is an absolute monarch, the condition of the church then becomes basically a mild Calvinistic Anglicanism. With her as the head, state control of religion, with very much a hodgepodge. One person characterized it this way. We had a Calvinistic theology, a Catholic ecclesiology, and an Arminian clergy. And in a very real sense, that was the fact of the matter. In the year 1588, you remember, there was a Spanish armada that was set forth by Spain to try to overthrow the Queen, and this had the support of the Roman Catholic Church because they judged Elizabeth to be the wrong ruler. The Pope called upon France and Spain to carry out a bull. The bull was issued by Pius V in the year 1570, and the Spanish Armada was the part to try to overthrow her. And this is what the bull said. He that reigns in the highest, to whom has been given all power in heaven and earth, entrusted the government of the one holy and Catholic apostolic church, outside of which there is no salvation, to one man alone on the earth, namely to Peter, the chief of the apostles, and to Peter's successor, the Roman pontiff, in the fullness of power. This one man he set up as the chief over all nations and all kingdoms, to pluck up, to destroy, to scatter, to dispose, to plant, and to build. Resting then upon the authority of him who has willed to place us in the supreme throne of justice, we declare the aforesaid Elizabeth a heretic, and in a better of heretics, and those that cleave to her in the aforesaid matters to have incurred the sentence of anathema and to be cut off from the unity of Christ's body. Moreover, we declare her to be deprived of her pretended right to the aforesaid realm and from all dominion, dignity, and privilege whatsoever. So you can see that the condition that Elizabeth was in was a very touchy point. She had foreign nations against her. She had a large amount of people in her land that had, maybe two-thirds of the people in the land, had a Roman Catholic orientation. They had a tradition in Roman Catholicism. They liked the ritual. They liked it. She didn't want to go to just let anybody decide what everybody wanted. For a reason that we'll show you in a few moments. And so she decided that she would have to try to walk sort of a tightrope. And so her religion was more pragmatic, what would support the realm, rather than what was the issue of truth in religion. After Elizabeth dies, and this was a great problem, who is going to succeed Elizabeth? Elizabeth was in love several times, but she never married. And therefore, when she dies, she is the last of the Tudor reign. You begin now the Stuart reign. The Stuarts come from Scotland, and James the VI is the king of Scotland, and he now becomes the ruler of the entire kingdom. And so the big question is, what will happen? James the VI, if you remember what has happened right in this period of time, James the First, 1603 to 1625, James the First, it comes at this time. He was James the Sixth of Scotland. He becomes James the First of the realm. He was reared in a Presbyterianism in Scotland. His mother, though, was a Catholic. His mother was Mary, Queen of Scots. And Mary, Queen of Scots, remember, was put to death by Elizabeth. So you have this person coming to the throne. He has Presbyterianism in his background, but but his mother was a Catholic. The Anglicans hoped that he would maintain episcopacy. So there are three, depending on which way this man goes when he comes to the throne, may determine the whole country of England. Will he revert to Presbyterianism? Will he stick with Anglicanism? Or will he relapse into Catholicism? And everybody is all uptight as to what will happen. He says to the Presbyterians this, "You are aiming at a Scots presbytery, which agreeth as well with monarchy as God and the devil. Then Jack and Tom and Will and Dick shall meet, and at their pleasure censure me and my council. Then Will will stand up and say, it must be thus. Then Dick will reply and say, nay, Mary, but we will have it thus. And therefore I say, the king shall decide." So he decides the king is going to decide, and the reason why he buys Anglicanism rather than Presbyterianism is because Anglicanism fits better with a monarchy than Presbyterianism does. So at this time, you get the continuation of the Elizabethan settlement. So James the First persecutes people who dissent, and you remember in the year 1620, you have a people who immigrate to America called the Pilgrims. They are the first group, and they are dissatisfied. They see no change, no possibility of religious freedom in England. They feel it's going to continue with Anglicanism, and so they immigrate. This is King James who decides to call a conference, and at this conference where he said that it's going to be the king shall decide, he decides that they're going to need a new Bible. The reason why they need a new Bible is because the Geneva Bible is being used in the land. Well, the Geneva Bible is an English Bible with Calvinistic footnotes. And the Calvinistic footnotes, if you read them carefully, would lead you to adopt Presbyterianism. And so he decides that he wants a Bible without any notes. He doesn't want any Schofields or any Geneva Bibles floating around. And so the King James Bible is commissioned. If you've wondered what the motivation for the King James Bible, the motivation was the king wanted a Bible without notes that would be uniform throughout the land, but would not have any Calvinistic footnotes. So the King James Bible is set forth. After James, we have Charles the First. Charles the First is a very strong royalist. And in this period of time, things are happening with the English monarchy. The absolute monarch, Henry VIII, Charles tries to be as absolute as Henry VIII. The people are very much in rebellion against an absolute monarchy. And since Charles I tries to impress his power very strongly upon the land, numerous things happen. He appoints a man as archbishop named Archbishop Laud. Now this man was a very high, what we call Anglo-Catholic. And he tries to make the land more Catholic. And he begins to persecute Calvinists. And so the church is becoming really more Catholic all the time and less Reformed. At this period of time, the Great Migration takes place. In the year 1640, what is called the Great Migration takes place, in which some 40,000 people migrate to America. It is said that America never had as many educated people at one time than it did at that time. A very high middle class with an educated belief moved to New England. They are described by Perry Miller in his book, Aaron into the Wilderness. They came to America as Puritans on their errand into the wilderness to set up what they felt would be a new theocracy. They wanted a church state with a purified church. The Pilgrims who came were not as rigid as the Puritans. The Puritans believed very firmly in a one form. And so the Massachusetts Bay Colony was set up by them to have a very pure form of church government and church doctrine. At this time, the people back under Charles, they are very uneasy. An armed revolt takes place in Scotland, and a civil war begins in England. And Cromwell defeats Charles I. Charles I had called a parliament. The Long Parliament rules during this period. And Cromwell becomes the head power at this time, particularly from the years 1653 to 58. When Cromwell is... let me jump back one thing. The Long Parliament at this period was called by the king because he needed money. And they set about... there was a struggle, power struggle going between the Parliament and the king. And this Parliament rewrote the 39 Articles of the Church of England. What they wrote eventually became known as the Westminster Confession of Faith. And they also wrote the Shorter Catechism, the Larger Catechism, and they were doing this for a more reformed church in England. It never really got off the ground because there was the turmoil. They finished their work, this Long Parliament. The Westminster Assembly was called and put into office by the Long Parliament, but it was never adopted by the Church of England. The Church of Scotland adopted these standards, and that is the standard Presbyterian confession to the present time. Cromwell himself, though, was not a Presbyterian, and he was not an Anglican. He was an independent. And so when he took control, there was independency, and he would not want to enforce Presbyterianism. And so there was pretty much laissez-faire during the latter part of his rule ecclesiastically. After Cromwell dies, there is nobody strong enough to rule the country, and so Charles II is restored in 1660, and for the next 25 years, once again, you have conformity going back to the Elizabethan period. Then James II comes on, and he's a Roman Catholic. So tremendous turmoil again in the nation of England. William and Mary come to rule in the Glorious Revolution, and there is toleration which is permitted in the land. So this is what happens in England. We'd have to say that England never really has a reformation. It has changes, it has influence, but it does not have the real reformation that took place in Switzerland or in Germany or in some of the other areas, such as the Scandinavian countries. There is the incorporation of Reformation truths in the model of the state church, which was controlled by the Queen. Now we want to jump over very quickly to Scottish history. The basic fact of Scottish history is that the Scottish share the same island, but yet they were in subordination to the English. The English were always trying to annex Scotland, and the Scottish people were always trying to remain independent. And so there's a power struggle going on between the two segments, the Scottish and the English. And so the Scottish have a tendency to ally themselves with anybody that will help get them independent. And so they would tend to ally themselves with France. And so the English would have to fight on two fronts, the Scottish at the top and the English with the French at the bottom. There is an old dynasty called the Stuart dynasty that went back to 1371. And then there was Robert II, Robert III, James I, James II, James III, and James IV, who marries Margaret Tudor, the sister of Henry VIII. So Mary, Queen of Scots, could claim the British throne because James IV was married to Margaret Tudor, and so the Tudor line and the Stuart line are intertwined by marriage. James the Fourth was killed in 1513 in a war with England. James the Fifth was only 1 year old and was not, of course, permitted to rule. And so a man named Archbishop Beaton was the regent at this time. And this regent, Archbishop Beaton, in the year 1538, went to war against Henry VIII. And he died, though, in 1542 and was not able to hold the power. The daughter of Mary, the daughter of James, was being brought up at this time. Beaton was the regent. Mary was sent to France at age 6 and promised to the French Dauphin. Beaton was assassinated, and there is a Mary of Lorraine who is the regent. So we come back now to Mary Stuart. Not on here at all, but Mary Stuart now is, just to refresh ourselves, Mary Stuart is a descendant of Margaret Tudor and the Stuart dynasty. So she has been in France. She has been reared as a Catholic. And she is brought back to Scotland after this long interplay in which you had a regent in the year 1542. Pardon me. She lives from 1542 to 87. So Mary Stuart is brought back from France to Scotland to rule. She is only, she was married at 16. She was to be the Queen of France, but the Dauphin died, so she was widowed at 18. She came back to claim her throne in Scotland, though. So this is just trying to get us plugged into what happens here. I don't expect you to remember all this because it's very difficult because of all these intermarriages. But anyway, Mary Stuart comes back to claim the throne of Scotland. Scotland is Protestant by this time. And she was sent by the Roman Catholics from France and was told that her duty was to reclaim Scotland for Catholicism. The way Scotland became Protestant was there was a tremendous migration into that area of people who had been in Geneva studying. So Calvinism had spread into that land and Protestantism had spread. There was also a tremendous struggle going on between the kings and the nobles. The nobles were trying to rise up against the strong kings and queens. And so oftentimes the nobles decided that they'd rather adopt another faith than Catholicism. So many of the nobles began to react against the power of the church, and they began to favor Protestantism. I said the church owned about a half of the land area, and the church life was low. Now, I just want to go through a few more statements about the preludes to reform in Scotland. There was, first of all, Lollard teaching that had infiltrated Scotland from England when Wycliffe had been there. And the teaching was, a true priest is one worthy of his office. Luther's teaching also influenced Scotland. Since Henry VIII came out against Luther, people who were opposed to Henry VIII, such as Scottish people, might want to see what was so bad about Luther. And they could sort of see that the things that Luther was saying were in opposition to the Roman Catholic Church, and they weren't particularly hep on the Roman Catholic Church because of its corruption. The Scottish Catholic Church was much more corrupt than perhaps any other church around. The morality of the clergy was low. The power that they wielded was very high. And having half of the land in the country, there was a tremendous amount of financial corruption. There was a man, Patrick Hamilton, in the year 1528, who was burned at the stake for Protestant heresy. Tyndale's New Testament entered at this period of time. So people were beginning to think about these various elements. Lutheranism, though, did not really have the strength to deal with the problems of Scotland, because Lutheranism, it was politically quietist, whereas Calvinism was politically activistic. In 1546, a man named Wishart brought Swiss Reformed thought to the land of Scotland, and he was burned at the stake. John Knox was his bodyguard. And we come now to John Knox. When Knox was around Wishart, he began to preach to a number of men, and he began to develop a fiery preaching style. In the year 1548, he was captured in a battle and sent to be a galley slave of the French. He eventually was exchanged as a prisoner of war in the year 1549 and began to be a government preacher. He was under Mary Tudor, but every day as he preached, he decided he couldn't stay there, and he left and went to Geneva. He began preaching to a congregation in Frankfurt, and then he went to Geneva in the year 1555. He then went to England and got married to a woman named Margaret Bowes. They had five sons. And then he went to Scotland in the year 1556 and started congregations. He was a powerful preacher and eventually got a strong hearing at this point. So what we have now, the two things that are going to determine what's going to happen in Scotland, is Mary Stuart versus John Knox. She comes there as a young, very attractive queen. She is 19 years old. Knox has just begun the work of reforming in Scotland. He has a tremendous hearing. He puts forth a book of discipline, in which he tries to set forth a new church polity, a new repair of the churches, compulsory universal education, and tries to relieve the poor. So he is bringing in the whole model from Geneva, a complete reform of the church from top to bottom of the whole educational system. And he's trying to put this in Scotland. And just as he is trying to do this, Mary Stuart returns. For the first 3 years, she's very successful. She plays her cards very well. She's a very beautiful girl. She has private mass, and while she's having her private mass, Knox is thundering against idolatry. Knox is 59. She is just a young girl when she first comes, 17. She marries a person named Lord Darnley, who is only 19 years old. So she's very young at this point. Lord Darnley becomes jealous of a person named Raziel, who is one of her secretaries, and Darnley kills Raziel, has him killed by friends. She has a child, and the question is, whose child is it? She bears a son named James. This James is going to be the James here. So Mary Stuart is still married to Darnley at this point. Darnley becomes sick, and she nurses him, but somehow he becomes blown up. Somebody assassinates him. And Bothwell was a friend of hers at this point. Bothwell is tried and found innocent. She marries Bothwell. So people are wondering what's going on. She looks like she's having an affair with one person, becomes pregnant, but it may not be by her husband. Her husband becomes sick. She nurses him. He's about to get better, and somebody blows her husband up. And her close friend strong man around the throne, she marries. And so people are wondering what's going on up there. And, of course, she's having mass being said, and the mass is to Knox a heresy and an idolatry. And so the people rise up in arms at this point. She is taken prisoner, and then she abdicates. So at this particular point, the Reformation is secure in Scotland. So Scotland, we're at 1570. By 1570 in Scotland, the Reformation is complete. They are very strong in their Presbyterianism. Now, this will help you another thing to understand your religious heritage. Because Scotland, at this point, right in here, becomes Presbyterian, it is able to do so, really, in the absence of a strong monarch. Because there is a turmoil of weak monarchs, and that the English rulers are trying to always put down the Scottish rulers, the church is free to develop as they see fit, and they come to a Presbyterianism. However, when this becomes the established faith, it's going to be bad for the Presbyterians, because Scotland is ruled by England for the most part. And so these rulers are going to try to persecute the Presbyterians and try to make them conform to Anglicanism. And so the Scotch-Irish Presbyterians, as they're called, they will migrate to America. And you see, when they come to America, a tremendous number will immigrate to America, and they will have a very strong dislike of a strong king. And that heritage will give rise, ultimately, to the reaction against the kings of England at the American Revolution. And so many American historians will say that the American Revolution was a Presbyterian revolution. One of the lines of the departure in the American Revolution was that the Anglicans supported the king and the Presbyterians were against him. And it's no accident that one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence was a Presbyterian preacher. So there is a strong correlation here. Knox dies in the year 1572. He died a poor man, and it was said of him that he did not make merchandise of the work of the Word of God. Although he was a man of strong power and could have become wealthy, he gave himself to preaching, to trying to establish the Reformation in Scotland. There are many interesting quotes about Knox. He was a very fiery person. He is said to have prayed to the Lord, "Give me Scotland or I die." And by his strong stand, Scotland went Presbyterian rather than Roman Catholic. There's a famous situation in which Knox and Mary Queen of Scots, had an interview in which she said they were discussing the true church. And she said that the true church is the Catholic Church. And he insisted that the true church was the Presbyterian Church. And she said, "My conscience tells me that the true church is the Catholic Church." And he said, "Madam, conscience requires knowledge." But they had some very interesting conversations. She feared his preaching more than anything else, and his preaching was the thing that turned eventually the country Presbyterian. And of course, her indiscretions in court caused her downfall. So this is what happens in the English Reformation. It is a reformation in one sense. There never is freedom of religion either place. In this period of time, any more than there is freedom of religion in Lutheranism or freedom of religion in Geneva. I think we'll close in prayer and let you ask questions. Father, we do want to thank you for the understanding that we can gain from history, and we see how the union of church and state has caused many problems within our history. We thank you for your overriding providence and for the fact that in our land there has not been a state church. We realize that an attempt to have a separation of church and state causes difficulties as well. And we must confess, Father, that we realize there will be no perfect harmony between ecclesiastical power and secular power until Jesus Christ unites both king and priesthood in himself. We thank you, Father, for our time together. In Jesus' name, amen.